Faisal Ahmed, inviting you to join us for an episode of Window on Islam.
Welcome to Window on Islam. Welcome to Window on Islam.
Welcome to Window on Islam.
People of the world, do you know the truth about Islam? Or do you think it's about bombing planes and killing innocent people? Forget about the lies. I'm here to tell you how it really is. You deserve to know the truth about this beautiful way of life. People of the world, Islam.
And you're back. You're listening to Window on Islam on WRPI Troy 91.5 on your FM dial. Today we have with us Maury Salakhan, the director of the Peace and Justice Foundation, which is a Washington, D.C. based human rights advocacy group. We'll be discussing the trial of Imam Jamil Al-Amin, the formerly known as H-Rap Brown, and we'll also continue on later on in the program to discuss some of the detentions of immigrants in the United States by the FBI and the INS, and perhaps touch on some other raids that the FBI has been conducting and look at that within the overall framework in peace and justice. With that, I'd like to introduce Maury. Are you with us there, Maury?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be with you. Alaikum salam. The last time Maury had joined us, I don't know if you remember, Maury, but we actually, believe it or not, we were talking about Imam Jamil, and it was before his trial. And I think just for those of us that don't know enough about Imam Jamil, perhaps you can just give us a little bit of his background, and we can continue from there.
Back in the 60s, Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin was known by his former name, H-Rap Brown. He was an activist, probably best known for his chairmanship of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was one of the leading, perhaps the leading, student-led organization in America, civil rights organization in America.
Mm-hmm.
He succeeded the brother who used to be known as Stokely Carmichael, later became known as Kwame Ture, but he succeeded him in the chairmanship of SNCC and basically made a name for himself in the process. He was a young activist known at the time for his dexterity with language and his in-your-face kind of confrontational style. But it's important to note, however, that the very militant H-Rap Brown, as he was known as then,
mm-hmm.
Was someone who you might say was a product of the environment in which he lived. Many of the most, in fact, of the students who were a part of SNCC were originally committed to creative nonviolence. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and some of his other mm-hmm. key aides and lieutenants within the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and as well as his colleagues and other civil rights organizations at the time, were basically spearheading the methodology for struggle in the movement at that time. And, you know, many of the students that came into the movement, many of the students came in with a commitment to creative nonviolence, but unfortunately they were met with very violent resistance in different parts of the South. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and to this day, folks who were not around at that time or, you know, it's hard to imagine the magnitude of violence that many of these civil rights workers and a large percentage of them being students from the various universities were met with. They were met with terrible violence and beatings, maimings, killings. A lot of folks died. I once asked Imam Jamil years ago when he was in the Washington area for a speaking engagement, and I had the pleasure of taking him back to the airport at the end of the day. I asked him on the way to the airport, what was it like? What was the civil rights movement like? And I'll never forget the first words that came out of his mouth was, it was a war. And this is exactly what it was. It was a low-intensity civil type of war, you know, that was going on for change, to bring about, you know, much-needed, long-overdue change in America. And, you know, there were many unsung heroes. I mean, many folk that you don't know their names, but they were an integral part of the movement, and the kind of advances that were made could not have been made without their sacrifices and their enormous contributions. But he was one of the, he was one of the lightning rods, and he was one of the main figures within that movement. In fact, brother, if you were to pick up any documentary, any well-made documentary, on the civil rights movement, at some point in that documentary, you're going to come across footage of H. Rapp Brown.
Well, from what you're saying, it comes as a bit of a surprise to me, and perhaps a lot of people who associate H. Rapp Brown with being violent by nature, or somebody who thought that violence was the only means to the achievement of civil rights. But it seems that he had associated with much more peaceful people, like Martin Luther King, for example. And later on, perhaps, did he continue with this type of approach to achievement of civil rights? I think was that his the only means that he'd used for the furthering of civil rights later on, after, say, the 60s, and after the clashes and the violence had toned down?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, he, like others who ended up resorting to the methodology of self-defense, and this is the way they viewed it. He wasn't violent by nature at all. The violence that he ended up expressing in many of his speeches was a reaction to the violence that civil rights workers down in Mississippi and Alabama and in other parts of the South were being confronted with, and largely in the North were being confronted with. He advocated self-defense. In fact, that's one of the reasons why he ended up being invited by the leadership of the Black Panther Party at the time to become a an honorary member of the party. And in fact, they made him, I believe, the Deputy Minister of Justice. And he was in the Black Panther Party for about 6 months, I believe. But, you know, if you, from reading the news reports and hearing some of the broadcast reports about his past in the wake of this unfortunate trial that just ended, you know, you would have thought that the Black Panther Party was the not just the main organization, but the only organization that he had ever been affiliated with. When in fact, again, his stint in the Black Panther Party was for about 6 months, and but he was, you know, he was widely respected as a student leader. And again, he advocated, you know, he advocated self-defense, that that the African American community, which was victimized by overt violence coming from, you know, organizations within the community, predicated on the doctrine of white supremacy. To police forces, not just local police forces, but even the federal police force, the FBI. I mean, through COINTELPRO. They planned all types of very dangerous and violent intrigues against people, most of whom, again, were committed to nonviolence.
Mm. Well, my understanding was that, similar to Malcolm X, that H. Rapp Brown underwent a change later on that what we as mainstream Muslims would call coming into true Islam,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the Nation of Islam or the Black Muslim Movement, as it was called. And after that, he had really not been involved with any type of militant type activity. And in fact, for the last, say, 20, 30 years, he had been a very peaceful person. Is this pretty much what happened as with Malcolm X later on in life when he had also left the Nation of Islam and embraced true Islam? Is that the same with H. Rapp Brown?
Well, you know, the answer to that question is really predicated on how you define militancy. Many would argue that Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin became even more revolutionary than was H. Rapp Brown. Revolutionary in the sense that he remained committed to positive and substantive change. He remained committed to that. Committed to the notion that America has to undergo a radical change in order to, you know, to bring about the promises of its creed. You know, he remained committed to that, but his methodology changed. As Imam Jamil would state, he, for the first time after his embrace of Islam, he had a program. He had a program of action that he felt would be the vehicle to bring about the kind of change that he aspired for as a, you know, one of the black radicals of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Al-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. I mean, I remember reading some of, you know, many of his thoughts in the autobiography of Malcolm X, where, you know, during that critical period when he was going through ideological transition from black nationalism to Islam,
mm-hmm.
There were those in the movement that at one point they you know, basically accused him of being confused, and they accused him of abandoning his revolutionary credentials, or they suspected that he was moving away from his revolutionary credentials, when in fact he was becoming even more revolutionary after his, you know, after his making the Hajj and his embrace of what he came to understand as true Islam, the Islam based upon the Quran and the Sunnah or traditions of the Prophet,
mm-hmm.
With his zeal for embracing truth and his zeal for wanting to see revolutionary change in America,
mm-hmm. Perhaps more ideological than physical, as before, after embracing Islam, I would think.
Ultimately, revolution, true revolutionary change within any society, is ideological. You cannot have a revolution, a true revolution, that can bring about the kind of fruits for all of mankind, for the benefit of all of mankind, without there being an ideological and spiritual revolution that must first take place within the heart.
For which Imam Jamil Al-Amin is known well today amongst Muslim students across the country. And just one question that came to mind for me was, after embracing Islam, did Imam Jamil in any way still advocate black supremacy, or was that something he left behind?
No, he left that completely behind. He embraced Islam in the fullest sense, and in fact, within his community, you know, he has a national kind of affiliation, some masajid and centers, most of them very small, but scattered around the U.S. and in, from what I understand, in parts of the Caribbean, that come under his leadership. Among them are, Caucasian Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he embraced Islam in the fullest sense, and he sees the brotherhood that Islam promises as a universal brotherhood. You know, and so no, he doesn't espouse any notions of black superiority or black nationalism or anything like that. Just
I think it's important to sometimes clarify that, because I think, as with Malcolm X, the two are often associated with this type of racism, which they left behind when embracing Islam, and the Islam actually acted as a catalyst. From my understanding, for them to really see racial equality through the means of Islam, and not through one color or one nation being superior to another, but absolute equality before God, in a spiritual sense. But with that, I'd like to bring our discourse to the current day situation, and my co-host Huma had some questions about that. Huma, go ahead.
Yes, Brother Mori, I thought maybe you could answer a few questions for us to just give our listeners some background about what exactly took place the night that Imam Jamil Amin was accused of committing certain crimes. Maybe you can give our listeners some background about that.
Yes, on March 16th, 2000, on the day before one of the major celebrations in the Muslim calendar, a warrant was served by two sheriff's deputies in Fulton County, Georgia, right in the heart of Atlanta on the West End. They were serving a warrant on Imam Jamil for a failure to appear in court. Now, the whole basis for the warrant has been called into question by his attorneys and others, given the fact that on the day that he was supposed to be in court, a freak ice storm hit the Atlanta, Georgia area and basically shut just about everything down. In fact, the judge that was supposed to have been in court that day didn't make it to court. From what I've been told, and according to what the record reflects, there were no proceedings on that day, yet there were some officers of the court that made it in. When it was discovered that Imam Jamil had not made it into court, but had in fact sent a couple of brothers from his community to see if there would be court on that day, they issued a failure to appear. Again, even though proceedings didn't take place on that day, you would have thought that it would have just rescheduled the court date, and he would have received the necessary papers and then reacted appropriately. But the short of it was that they issued a warrant for his failure to appear. And I think it's also important for those who are not familiar with this case to know why the warrant, what the basis of his having to be in court was. A few months earlier, in nearby Cobb County, Imam Jamil was stopped by a police officer. And when he was asked to produce his driver's license and registration, when he opened his wallet, the officer saw a badge. And he ended up being cited for impersonating a police officer, when in fact he contested, and it was later affirmed by a letter from the mayor of a little town called Whitehall, Alabama, in Lowndes County, Alabama, that in fact Imam Jamil had been made an honorary police officer on that force. And so the badge had been issued by the mayor of that town, who had been also a an old colleague of Imam Jamil back in the days of when he was H.R.A.P. Brown, registering voters down in that part of Alabama and in Mississippi. He affirmed on his own letterhead that we issued that badge. He is in fact an auxiliary police officer in the town of Whitehall. There was another basis. He was also cited for receiving stolen goods, as it turned out, despite the fact that Imam Jamil had papers confirming that he had purchased the car from a legitimate used car lot. The automobile, according to the authorities, had history to it. It had one time been reported stolen. So, in fact, he was accused of receiving stolen goods. And then the third crime, if you will, or violation of the law, was that he was driving without insurance. That was the only legitimate complaint.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, despite the fact that Imam Jamil, the papers of the vehicle, it was affirmed that he had the badge legitimately, the prosecutor still wanted to pursue the case and offered him a deal. I think the deal was somewhere between 90 days and 6 months in jail if he would plead. Well, of course, he refused and said that he would prefer his day in court. One thing led to another, the ice storm, his failure to appear, the bench warrant issued, and then a few months later, it served, and on the night that it served, a very tragic and violent gunfight erupts between the sheriff's deputies and an unknown assailant, who the surviving deputy identified after hours of surgery, and no doubt heavily sedated, identified as Imam Jamil.
If I might interrupt, there's a couple points that, salient points that, in my mind, from what I've heard from you and also what I've read, he was facing at most 6 months in prison, which to me is interesting. It's not something completely, you know, it's not like
right.
he was running from something like a great crime or something.
Right.
And the testimony that you mentioned about him being identified under the influence of many drugs, you mentioned morphine,
right.
and I've actually read I've read articles published in mainstream media about this, you know, that this is something which is, to me, is a real surprise that even on, you know, CNN.com, other places, the weakness of the evidence in this case is just profoundly, it's unbelievable, and it's not something that a small group of people are pointing out, but it's something that experts in the field have really mentioned, have really worried about this. That's something probably that comes as a surprise to you as well, that he was indeed found guilty on all 13 counts based on such weak evidence.
Just to go back to where you left off, the night that he was served the warrant, where exactly was Imam Jamil?
Well, we don't know. I don't know where Imam Jamil was. I don't know if he was on the West End or if he was somewhere mm-hmm. else. Imam Jamil chose not to take the stand during mm-hmm. the trial. And so that question... I don't recall that question being raised by the defense at all, in terms of, you know, laying out, okay, Imam Jamil was at X, Y, and Z. It just didn't happen that way. I believe the whole focus was on, during the trial, presenting the evidence that that basically called into question the case that the state felt that it had against him as the lone assailant responsible for the death of one officer and the serious injury of the other. I think it's important to point out that there were a number of things for me and many others, especially for those of us who have known this man for a good number of years, were like red flags for us. The first being what he, the just the nature of the crime itself. Now, I don't know if either of you have ever met Imam Jamil, or if you've had an opportunity to talk with someone who knows him and has known him for a number of years. But he is a very mild-mannered individual, very, very calm-spirited man. And when I heard the scenario that had been outlined when this case first erupted, I just said, no, there's no way. I mean, the only way that Imam Jamil could do what they have accused him of doing is if he just went crazy, if he snapped. And then, you know, fortunately for me, I was able to visit him within days of his arrest. Within about 2 or 3 weeks of his arrest, I visited him, and I saw no indication whatsoever that his psychological state had changed in any way. In fact, you know, I was really amazed at how centered he remained, you know, though this storm was brewing around him.
We actually will be playing an interview with Imam Jamil Al-Amin shortly, and certainly one of the things that surprised me upon hearing it is how calm and how, like you said, centered and he is in you know, discussing what the events that had happened to him. Certainly not somebody who seems emotional, but one who understands what's happening and thinking rationally on how to to convey the truth to the American people. So I guess this is a good time. We'll play that, and if anybody would like to call in with questions or comments, you can call us at WRPI. The number is 518-276-6248. Again, if you have any questions for Maury Salakhan, the director of the Peace and Justice Foundation, feel free to give us a call. And with that, this is Imam Jamil Al-Amin speaking from the Fulton County Jail, discussing the charges brought against him.
On March 16, 2000, Fulton County Sheriff Deputy Ricky Kinchum was killed, and Sheriff English was shot and injured in the neighborhood where I have lived, worked, and prayed. Indeed, this tragedy occurred across the street from the masjid I founded. I have been accused by the state of Georgia of having committed these crimes. Let me declare before the families of these men, before the state and anyone who would care to know the truth, that I am innocent of the 13 charges that have been brought against me. Let me also declare that I am joined at the heart with his widow and her children at the loss of a husband and father. I drink from the same bitter cup of sorrow as the siblings at the loss of a beloved brother. I am powerless to do anything to ease your pain and suffering except pray that Allah makes you wisdom, and in your hour of need, that he grants you peace for the remainder of your days. I have been maliciously maligned, scandalized, and vilified in the press by the police establishment, before the court and world opinion, even before I was charged with any crime. They have sought to marginalize my humanity and humiliate my family. They have done their level best to reduce me to a one-dimensional monster that is a composite of a Black Panther with a negative connotation, a cop killer, and a fictional character of the Godfather. I am no monster. I am a human being created by Allah, and I am an instrument of his purpose. I am entitled to every right and every consideration as every other human being, including fairness, a fair trial, and the presumption of innocence. Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard, as a representative of the state, has asked for my death. Mr. Howard can have my death based on the power of the state, but not on the basis of justice. He can only have my death because my life belongs to Allah, and he alone, in life and in death, will deliver me from my tormentors and persecutors. I will pray for those who despitefully abuse me because of power, prestige, or blind ambition. For they must face the ultimate bar of justice and face the judge of judges and answer the question, by what right and whose permission did you ask for death of this human being and my devoted servant. This statement was made in the court at my arraignment on January 19th, the year 2001.
This was an interview with Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly known as H. Rap Brown, from the Fulton County Jail, given just before the start of his trial. You're listening to WRPI Troy, 91.5 on your FM dial. This is Window on Islam, and we are discussing the trial and recent conviction of Imam Jamil Al-Amin, and we will be with you for the next half an hour and welcome your calls. The number is 518-276-6248. With us is Maury Salatan, the director of the Peace and Justice Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based human rights advocacy group.
That's an amazing statement. It really touches your heart to listen to that. I was just thinking as he was speaking, how much did September 11th prejudice and racism play an influence on this trial? Actually, Maury, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, it played an enormous... it had an enormous impact.
I understand at the beginning they actually moved the trial from the Atlanta.
No, it wasn't moved from Atlanta.
Okay.
The date was moved.
The date was changed. Okay.
Initially, jury selection was supposed to begin on the 12th. Jury selection was originally supposed to start on September 12th, the day after the tragic attacks. And for obvious reasons, the defense attorney requested a change, a postponement of the date, and the judge readily agreed to it because it was very clear that as prejudiced as the atmosphere was prior to September the 11th for any Muslim accused of committing a crime anywhere in America, it was magnified many times by the tragedy of September the 11th and the rush to judgment by certain organs within the United States and the media to pin the responsibility for that tragedy at the feet of Muslims.
Mm.
So his case was moved. The jury selection began in January, and right after the jury was selected, and this was a pool of about 1,500 potential jurors. After they were selected, then the trial began. I was there for the first week of the trial in Atlanta. I was there for opening arguments, and the government's case, the star witness, the surviving deputy, etc. And I, even though I realized how political a trial this was and that anything can happen in political trials, and I had cautioned folks in Atlanta, in Washington, and other cities about that, still, I was very optimistic after the first week. When I returned back to Washington, I was optimistic that, that justice was going to win the day. I was guardedly optimistic that it would happen, but unfortunately it did not.
Mm.
Imam Jamil did not receive the benefit of presumption of innocence, not from day one of this unfortunate ordeal, and that's the reason why at the end of the day the verdict was as it was. I mean, the jury just completely ignored the enormous inconsistencies in the state's case, beginning with the blood, and the fact that Imam Jamil was not wounded, despite the fact that both deputies maintained before his capture. Well, the one Deputy Kinchin died the following day, but before he died, he stated that he had shot the assailant in the stomach area. And English, also, the surviving deputy, maintained that the assailant had been shot. The headlines around the country were that, former Black Panther H. Brad Brown, a radical militant from the 60s, was a wounded fugitive being sought. And it was supposed to have been a blood trail leading to an abandoned house in the area. All of this, the 911 caller who said a few blocks away there was someone begging motorists for a ride, someone that was bleeding and begging motorists for a ride. I mean, all of this kind of went out the window when days later Imam Jamil was apprehended in Alabama and he had no injuries, none whatsoever. And so but the state based its whole case on the questionable identification of the surviving deputy, who also maintained that the assailant had gray eyes when Imam Jamil's eyes are brown, who asserted early on in his earliest reports that the assailant was wearing a dark Islamic-looking overgarment or a trench coat. I mean, in some reports, and I still have them, some of the initial media reports, it was a black trench coat. Others said it was a black overgarment. But that black overgarment, whatever it was, by the time of the trial, had been transformed into a tan-colored or yellowish-colored overgarment. The gray eyes were covered by yellow-tinted glasses. It's just amazing the kind of things that came, the kind of inconsistencies that came out of this case, and yet he ended up being convicted.
Yeah, actually, I was wondering, many people contend that when Jamil Al-Amin was active in Black Panthers, he was hated by the police establishment. And many years later, 30 years later, after he settled in a community that loves him, that he supported, that he takes care of as their spiritual leader, they came back to get their revenge, as one would say. Do you think that that could be some type of possibility?
Well, regardless of where it stemmed from, there was an obvious and very strong bias that lingered against Imam Jamil. We learned during the course of this trial, through the process of discovery, where attorneys from both sides have to share information that they've gathered with one another, that Imam Jamil, for a five-year period, was being investigated. He and his community were investigated and infiltrated by agents of the government. This is very important. They had paid informants planted in the community mosque on the west end of Atlanta. For 5 years, the FBI, probably the ATF, the FBI, I know it was the FBI, and I'm pretty sure it was the ATF as well, along with were part of a task force that was set up within the Atlanta Police Department. It was a special task force set up. In 1995, and we would learn later that this was during the period when this five-year probe was going on. In 1995, there was a young drug dealer that was shot in the leg on the West End. And he told the authorities he didn't know who shot him, but they pressured him to say it was Imam Jamil. They showed him a photograph. They said, "This is the man who shot you." Days later, after Imam Jamil had been publicly identified as a suspect, it's important to note that even police officers, and this is a part of the public record. This was in one of the published in one of the newspaper articles that came out during the time. Even Atlanta police officers thought that it was quite amazing that federal agents would become involved in a case that under normal circumstances was a routine aggravated assault case. The young man didn't die. He was injured. he didn't die. So it was an aggravated assault case, but the feds became involved in that, and that raised eyebrows within the Atlanta Police Department. Well, that's because they didn't know, the rank and file didn't know that this probe was going on. So they were trying to get Imam Jamil. They were trying to get him, they were trying to get him, and they could get nothing on him during that five-year period. And so I should also note that, because I think this is relevant, and this relates back to the question about militancy and how you define it. A man by the name of Daniel Pipes, who was well known in certain circles, certainly among many Muslims, he is known, and within conservative circles, he is a well-known analyst, someone who is considered to be, quote-unquote, an expert on the Middle East and on terrorism, et cetera. He's like the bosom buddy, the twin of Stephen Emerson. He wrote a piece that was published in the New Republic on February 21st. It was published, and this was less than a month prior to the tragedy on the West End, in which he identified a number of American-born Muslims that he considered a threat to the American way of life. And Imam Jamil was the first name on the list. Imam Jamil was mentioned. Siraj Wahaj was mentioned. Mahmoud Abdul Rauf was mentioned. An imam in the Washington area by the name of Muhammad Alassi was mentioned. But Imam Jamil was the first one on the list. And so, again, these are all indications that that he has been followed. He has been very closely monitored. And there have been attempts to get something on him. What happened in 95 ended up backfiring in their faces when the young man days later came forward and stated, you know, publicly that they pressured him to say it was Imam Jamil who shot him in the leg, when he had maintained early on that he didn't know who shot him. The young man ended up, you know, getting his life together. He embraced Islam, became a member of the community under Imam Jamil's leadership, you know.
Yeah, I understand he's very well known in his area in Atlanta. He's helped the community quite a bit, and they look up to him as a role model. I wonder how, if you know any of the reaction from his community, what they're feeling now, what they plan to do.
It's interesting because Imam Jamil's community, believe it or not, extends beyond the Muslims. On the West End, they have, I mean, the community as a whole, they have so much respect for this man. Most of the people who have resided on the West End for the last 15, 20, 30 years, they credit Imam Jamil and members of his community for helping to clean up and stabilize the West End. You know, before Imam Jamil moved into the West End, after he left New York, he was imprisoned, in fact, at Rikers Island. For his political activities, he was paroled in 1976, and upon his release, he requested a parole transfer, was called an interstate compact agreement with the state of Georgia, which he received, and he relocated there. He made Hajj, and he came back and began the work of establishing a community. Now, when he began that work, the West End of Atlanta was known as a basket case. I mean, there's a park right across the street from where his store and other small businesses are located, across also from the house that has served as the mosque for, you know, the past 25-plus years. There's a park across the street called the West End Park. When Imam Jamil first relocated there, families couldn't frequent that park because it was just a very dirty, nasty, unsafe place to be. I mean, you could, you know, children could stumble over needles in the park, or, you know, drug dealings routinely took place in the park, and other things that take place in areas that are blighted. and neglected. The Muslim community